It is a major shift in federal policy that treats Alaska tribes similarly to tribes in the lower 48.
The Interior Department considers allowing trust status for tribal lands. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new documentary on one family's year in the Brooks Range in a hand-built cabin.
And I thought, boy, I want more of this. I'd love to spend the entire summer up there, not knowing that the 6 weeks I had been there was the entire summer.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The U.S. Department of Interior has proposed a rule change that would allow Alaska tribes to ask the federal government to take their lands into trust. The request isn't always granted, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, today's announcement is a legal turn that could vastly expand the recognition and authority of tribal sovereignty in Alaska.
Tribal advocates are celebrating the department's announcement. Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller says it corrects a wrong-headed policy that excluded Alaska tribes from an important tool of self-governance.
This is huge. It is a major shift in federal policy that treats Alaska tribes similarly to tribes in the lower 48.
If the federal government agrees to take a tribe's land in trust, it in effect creates a patch of Indian country where state jurisdiction is limited and tribes can have law enforcement powers. The Interior Department cites the policy as a way to improve public safety in Alaska villages. The rule would apply only to lands owned by tribes, not the millions of acres owned by Alaska Native corporations. Kendall Miller says most Native villages sit on a patchwork of different types of land, so the rule change is limited in creating village-wide tribal law enforcement.
Clearly, it's not going to wind up being the panacea to fix all problems in rural Alaska, but it very well may be a potential model that would work for some communities.
Kendall Miller won a federal district court case last year arguing the secretary is allowed to take Alaska tribal lands in trust. Anchorage attorney Don Mitchell, an ardent opponent of Alaskan tribal sovereignty, says creating trust status for tribally owned lands conflicts with the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
It certainly is rolling back ANCSA, and that's exactly why the proponents of this change have persuaded their friends inside the Department of the Interior to do this.
Mitchell says the implications could be enormous because any landowner, including Native corporations, could transfer lands to an Alaska tribe, and those lands could in effect become an Indian reservation. With ANCSA, Congress agreed to convey millions of acres and nearly $1 billion to newly created Native corporations. The state of Alaska, like Mitchell, contends the settlement was Congress's rejection of creating Indian reservations across Alaska. The state is appealing the court decision that paved the way for the policy change. Kip Knutson, who runs Governor Sean Parnell's Washington, D.C. office, says it's important to defend the integrity of the 1971 Settlement Act.
Well, I mean, it's sort of the underpinning of our land status in the state, and it's an underpinning of a tremendous amount of economic activity in the state. And so if we start unraveling it or amending it, there's probably a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration.
Kendall Miller says Congress never took away the Interior Secretary's power to accept Alaska tribal lands in trust. The announcement today seemed to split Alaska's two senators. Mark Begich said it would improve tribal self-determination, while Lisa Murkowski said she had questions about breaking established policy. The Interior Department now kicks off a 60-day comment period on the proposed rule. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The National Science Foundation's new Arctic research vessel Sikulyak is nearing completion. The $200 million project has experienced delays, but as KUAC's Dan Ross reports, final work is taking place at a Wisconsin shipyard.
The Sikulyak will be operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks out of Seward, but it remains a long way from Alaska waters. Seward Marine Center Director Dan Oliver says the project's about 9 months behind schedule. Oliver blames numerous technical problems related to integration of the 261-foot vessel's complicated electronic and mechanical equipment, most recently with its high-tech propulsion system, which is being worked on at a Lake Michigan shipyard in Wisconsin.
It is having a lube oil system modification to both of the Z drives. The ship should have that work completed by the middle of next week and is scheduled to undock and be refloated on the 10th of May.
The Sikulyak has been in and out of the water numerous times for testing since its ceremonial launch in October 2012. Oliver says delays are expected when a one-of-a-kind vessel is built, and the project is well within its $200 million budget.
I've got something on the order of about $20 million bucks left to get the ship through post-delivery period, get it through all the, essentially a year's worth of post-delivery trials.
The university is scheduled to take delivery of the ship in late May, after which it'll begin the long journey to Alaska.
We'll bring it out to the Pacific through the Panama Canal, and we start our first round of funded science this fall.
The research projects will take place in waters between California, Hawaii, and Guam through January 2015. The Sikulyak will then head for Alaska, making a brief first stop at its home port of Seward before continuing north.
We'll take it up into the Bering Sea, do some ice trials with the ship to evaluate ice breaking performance and to train the crew and to operate the science systems in ice. And we'll do that in the Bering Sea in the mid-March to early April timeframe next year.
Sikulyak is the Inupiaq word for young sea ice, and the ship is designed to travel through ice up to 2.5 feet thick. It'll be unique in the U.S. scientific research fleet, providing expanded capacity in Arctic and Antarctic waters. The ship will be contracted out for projects. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
About 13,000 Alaskans signed up for health insurance on healthcare.gov during the open enrollment period that closed March 31st. The two insurers offering plans on the exchange in Alaska shared their enrollment figures today with APRN. Moda Health says it has about 7,700 healthcare.gov enrollees in Alaska, and the company is still processing some additional signups. Primera Alaska enrolled 5,300 people on the exchange. Before the troubled launch of healthcare.gov, the company had hoped for more customers. But Primera spokesperson Melanie Kuhn is satisfied with the numbers.
I think we readjusted our expectations. We're very pleased with how enrollment went based on the slow start to the exchange and the hiccups they had in the very beginning, and then the last-minute changes that were made where people could extend. And so to look back and try to look at what we were thinking at the beginning, it's just such a different story.
Both companies are also reporting substantial enrollment off the federal exchange. 2,000 Primera customers opted to enroll directly, and 700 people bypassed the federal website to sign up with Moda Health. The insurance plans are the same on and off the exchange, but subsidies are only available on the exchange. The Skagway ferry dock is floating again after a contractor hired by the state brought the sunken dock to the surface, but it's still not ready to host Alaska Marine Highway ferries. Western Marine Construction of Juneau began working at low tide yesterday morning, pumping water out of the dock floats. State Department of Transportation spokesperson Jeremy Woodrow said all 24 chambers that float the dock were flooded. The state-owned ferry dock sank last Thursday. Now that the dock is floating again, DOT and engineers are inspecting it to figure out what needs fixing. Skagway city officials have theorized a potable water pipe that runs from the ferry terminal to the dock and underneath may have burst, flooding the hollow concrete compartments that float the dock. Ferry service has been suspended to Skagway until May 9th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, it's finals week at UAA, and that means one thing: cramming.
Every year I procrastinate. Every semester, every year. Just, I mean, look at me. I mean, I'm never organized.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
A bill requiring school districts to implement sexual abuse education seemed poised to become law during the recent Alaska legislative session. Governor Sean Parnell supported Aaron's law. The Senate passed it, and the House version had 21 co-sponsors. But as KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, House Bill 233 got stuck in finance.
House Finance Committee co-chair Bill Stultz says he's not sure why Aaron's law didn't get heard in his committee. He calls it a casualty of a hectic session.
I guess I'll call it falling through the cracks, because it wasn't one that I had any animus toward or any interest. I was dealing with so many crime bills, and I don't know how that one slipped through. I can't even tell you much of the content of it because I didn't really look at it.
HB 233 unanimously passed the House Education Committee at the end of March and went on to House Finance. House Speaker Mike Chenault says he doesn't recall why he referred it there, since the bill had no fiscal note. Chenault was the last of 21 representatives to sign on to co-sponsor the bill. He doesn't know why it was held up.
Sometimes it's inner turmoil. Sometimes it's just not the right time. Sometimes it's somebody doesn't like it. If it had got to the floor, it probably would have passed.
Of the roughly 380 bills introduced on the House side, Chenault says only 68 House bills passed this year.
People were concentrating on the big issues that affected the state versus other issues that didn't quite get to the top of the pot.
Democratic Representative Garen Tarr introduced Aaron's law. She says teaching kids to speak up when someone touches them inappropriately is a big issue for the state.
This is a transformational legacy type of legislation where 10, 20 years down the line, you've made a difference in the lives of thousands of Alaskans, and we should have done it this year.
Tarr says she was shocked and embarrassed the bill died.
We could have done the right thing and given kids a voice on a very important issue. That effort will be delayed by at least a year now. We'll come back and we'll be ready to work on it again next year. The sad news is there's kids that need the information now.
Aaron's law is named after 29-year-old Aaron Marin from Illinois, who was sexually abused as a child. Marin travels around the country advocating for sexual abuse education in schools. She spent a week in Alaska in March. She talked to lawmakers, testified on the bill, and participated in the governor's annual Choose Respect rally. Marin wonders why the bill died, especially since it had support from both sides of the aisle. While the House version of the bill was sponsored by a Democrat, the Senate's version was carried by Republican Senator Liesl McGuire.
It's a bipartisan issue. I'm not sitting here arguing abortion, death penalty. I'm arguing protecting kids, and that's the only ones that should be against this bill are the ones that have something to hide, the perpetrators themselves.
Aaron's law has passed in 12 states. Most recently, Marin testified in Rhode Island and will soon take her campaign to Canada, then to Australia. But she says she's not done in Alaska.
I'm not going away. You can vote this down all you want. I'm going to continue to come back and pound on your doors and get others to support this bill until you pass it.
The Alaska legislature declared April Sexual Assault Awareness Month. According to the resolution, 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will report being victims of sexual assault. Speaking out against sexual assault is an important first step toward eliminating the crime. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Middle schoolers from across Anchorage today had a chance to hear from gubernatorial candidates about a variety of issues the state is facing. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
Over 100 students representing all of the Anchorage School District's middle schools gathered in the lobby of the Lusac Library's Wilda Marston Theater. While they were waiting for the forum to begin, students and teachers munched on Moose's Tooth Pizza while mingling with gubernatorial candidates Byron Mallott, Bill Walker, and current Governor Sean Parnell.
Where are you guys from?
Here.
Welcome. Glad you guys are here. So what do you guys hope to learn today?
Once the pizza was finished, everyone filed into the auditorium to hear the candidates respond to a number of questions generated by students and teachers who worked together to research topics they thought Alaska's next governor needs to address. Robert King is an eighth grader at Clark Middle School.
Our question is, do you think Alaskans should be required to show a photo ID to vote? Why or why not?
When the candidates addressed the question during the forum, they answered with a unanimous no, primarily because it would limit Alaskans' ability to vote, especially in rural communities. Corin Kotsky is an eighth grader at Romig Middle School. He was particularly interested in the candidates' responses to education-related questions.
I would like to see another increase in the base student allocation and more stability for the jobs of teachers, so teachers don't have to be worrying about retirement and class sizes will be reduced, so there can be more one-on-one working with teachers and students.
All of the candidates said they are in favor of improving Alaska's education system. Republican candidate Governor Sean Parnell says education funding has increased substantially since he has been in office. Independent candidate Bill Walker says the best way to increase education funding is for the state to generate more revenue with more resource development. And Democratic candidate Byron Malott says education must be funded fully and create certainty for students, teachers, and administrators. But Romig 8th grader Aaron Jenkins wasn't satisfied with those answers. He wanted more specifics from the candidates.
I was hoping to hear some of the 7th period that they're proposing for high schools next year. Yeah, they did talk about their plans to increase the budget for schools, but not their plans for the schools themselves, which I would have liked to hear.
Other topics range from the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and the expansion of Medicaid in Alaska, to the growth of Alaska's economy and how to strike a balance between new construction and maintaining existing infrastructure. Byron Malott, the Democratic candidate, was happy with the forum's turnout, and he says it's important that adults work to get young people interested and involved in the political process.
In many ways, Alaska is, it's a vast land, but it's a small community, and children influence every aspect of our lives. They should be our highest priority.
The forum was organized by AARP Alaska and moderated by Andrew Halcrow of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce and Janine English, the incoming AARP national president. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Tomorrow marks the unofficial beginning of climbing season on Denali, when base camp gets set up for the 1,000-plus climbers that will make an attempt to summit North America's highest peak. KTNA's Philip Manning spoke with base camp manager Lisa Roderick about the upcoming season.
For a few months each year, one of the busiest airports in Alaska isn't technically an airport at all. It's Denali's base camp on the Kahiltna Glacier. The vast majority of climbers fly in from Talkeetna to the camp at just over 7,000 feet to start their trek. On arrival, climbers are met by base camp manager Lisa Roderick.
As climbers fly in, I help unload the planes and just facilitate getting the planes moving and keeping things, you know, running smooth. And as the climbers are done climbing the mountain, then I call the air service and get their flight out.
Lisa Roderick doesn't work for the National Park Service. Instead, she works for the air services in Talkeetna, whose job it is to ferry climbers back and forth to Denali. She keeps cards for each climbing group that tell who they are, what air service they flew in with, and what languages they speak. Many of those cards do not list English, so Lisa sometimes has to improvise her communication.
It's a lot of sign language with some of the climbers that don't speak English, and it just works out. You know, you just point to an airplane and say, take your stuff over there.
On Wednesday, Lisa Roderick was busy arranging gear and consulting her checklist. Unlike climbers, whose supplies are centered around getting up and down the mountain, her gear involves communications equipment and long-term shelter, which comes with a lot of baggage.
Basically, it's just making sure I have all the equipment that I need up there. I have solar panels that charge 4 marine batteries, so make sure I got all the equipment in tip-top shape, and I have a bunch of radios that I use up there.
While some climbers have begun their treks already, 12 as of Wednesday, most won't arrive until mid-May or later. The heart of climbing season in May and June is when base camp earns the nickname Kehiltna International Airport. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
A documentary showing statewide on 360 North this evening chronicles the wilderness adventures of Gene Aspin and Tom Irons. Arctic Sun, Fulfilling the Dream, is the story of Gene, her husband Tom, and their son Luke as they spend a year in the Brooks Range, out of contact, and building their own cabin. When she was in her 20s, Jean went into the Arctic with her first husband, living off the land for 4 years.
Actually, we put a canoe into the Yukon at Circlin, canoed down the river, and then pulled up into the Brooks Range, and didn't start a cabin until quite late in the fall. And it was quite an adventure. That's my first book, Arctic Daughter.
Tom, I wanted to ask you also about the beginning of your experience. You were working in California, then you moved to Arizona. When Jean first talked about the Arctic, what did you think about the prospect of going to a place that most who aren't familiar with it would consider a scary, sub-zero, formidable wilderness?
Well, it was interesting. I had read her first book, and I was real clear. I had no desire to visit Alaska, let alone consider living there. It took her 6 years to drag me to Alaska. And basically, she's never been able to get Alaska out of my system. I fell in love with it the first summer that I spent here. We spent 6 weeks of the summer up in the Brooks Range on a very beautiful lake, very large, beautiful lake. And I thought, boy, I want more of this. I'd love to spend the entire summer up there, not knowing that the 6 weeks I had been there was the entire summer.
How does living in the wilderness, completely out of contact with family, friends, really anyone, how does this change you and change your perspective on life?
When Tom and I and our son, who was 6 at the time, and our woman friend Lori flew into the Brooks Range for 14 months. We had scheduled one flight to come in around November with the idea that we were hoping to do some filming and send the film out then, and to let our families know that we had actually survived. At that point, Lori left, so then it was just Tom and I and Luke that would live there until the following summer when breakup came, and then after that we explored some into the mountains and then canoed the 600 miles back out. So it was very remote. So I think a lot has to do with how you take the experience of being remote. Some people end up, I hear people say all the time, I couldn't live with my husband for, you know, that amount of time without interruption.
Why was this or is this important, this Herculean effort to move above the Arctic Circle, build a cabin, live for first a year? Why are these types of experiences important?
For me, that touch with the planet is fundamental to who I am. Perhaps my early life introduced me to that. I think when people ask, why is it necessary to preserve wilderness? Why should we not just turn it all into fuel for our cars? And the answer to me is that this planet is who we are. We evolved here. Our spiritual roots are in this planet. And when we distance ourselves from that, we begin to lose touch with our own souls.
Jean Aspin and Tom Irons and their son Luke are the subjects of the documentary Arctic Sun, Fulfilling the Dream, showing this evening on 360 North statewide. It's finals week at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and that means many students are crunching a very large amount of work into a very short amount of time. An Anchorage woman has found a creative way to help students beat the stress of the week. APRN intern Jolene Almendarez has the story.
Students have 16 weeks to hash out a plan for academic success. The final exam itinerary is in every student syllabus from day one. But in coffee shops and study areas on the UAA campus this week, a random sampling of students confirm procrastination and cramming are the name of the game.
I've got about 12 books that I've got to cover before tomorrow, so.
And how long have you had to read the books?
I've had all semester to read them.
Let's just say my final starts in 2 hours and I started the study guide an hour ago.
Every year I procrastinate. Every semester, every year. Just, I mean, look at me. I mean, I'm never organized. Everything is done at the last minute with no sleep prior to these exams.
Because I decided to, you know, try to go all night around 5 a.m., I ended up falling asleep. And I had set an alarm so I'd make it to my final, but I slept through the first 20 minutes of it. But I got it done. So I think no harm, no foul in the end.
That's Sean Cahill, Helen Lindemood, Chan Saturn, and Brendan Hernandez, who are among the marathon studiers prepping for exams. Amid the caffeine runs and last-minute readings, students can find reprieve from the stress at the consortium library.
You're the cutest!
A golden lab lays on a blanket at the entrance of the library, turning belly up for tummy rubs when students pass by. He's sitting next to Ashley McDougall, the owner and trainer of Pinnacle Canine Services.
This is Charlie I have with me. He's a one-year-old, and he's in training to be a diabetic alert dog. So he's got a bright future.
McDougall is a former UAA student. Library Dean Steve Rollins asked if she was interested in having her dogs participate in the puppy therapy during finals week after a professor put them in contact with each other last semester. McDougall agreed immediately. She's already aware of the health benefits of interacting with animals.
The dogs, it's been proven that when you pet and interact with the dogs, it releases good hormones like oxytocin. So it just kind of helps all around with the stress of the time. Everybody comes in stressed, uptight. You see their shoulders, they're kind of frowning. They come in, interact for a few minutes, and you see smiles and lots of stuff.
Charlie, visit. Hi. Puppy therapy is being offered throughout the week in the library from 2 to 4 p.m. Thursday and 4 to 6 p.m. Friday. A golden retriever named Remy splits the shift with Charlie to give students emotional support. In Anchorage, I'm Jolene Almendarez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Margaret Friednauer in Haines, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Jolene Almendarez from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.